This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you by the Friends of the Magic Word, and we'd like to welcome the newest members, Mr. Carl Thornton, Curtis the Medalist, and William Jacobson. Thank you guys for your financial support and for joining the Friends of the Magic Word. And if you are not yet a financial supporter and you have the means to contribute either on a one-time donation or on an ongoing pledge, we would appreciate any and everything that you can provide us. That kind of helps keeps this podcast going and offsets a lot of our expenses. Well, this week we are going to invite a guest who was a featured speaker at the recent convention in Columbus, Ohio at the Magi Fest here this past January 2018, and that's Doug Eisenberg. Now, if you weren't at the Magi Fest, by the way, which was a wonderful convention, and I highly recommend that you attend, the next best thing to being there is to go back and listen to my daily updates from the convention floor, and the next best thing perhaps would be to go ahead and sign up for next year. You should definitely attend. Joshua J. And Andy Gladwin do a great job of producing a great convention, so I highly recommend that you attend this convention. Nevertheless, the first speaker out of the chute at their morning session on the first day was Doug Eisenberg, who is an internet attorney out of Atlanta, Georgia. Now, I thought that was good positioning for him because it kind of set the tone, if you will, for the rest of the convention, because I would say that the average age must have been in the early 30s, maybe mid-30s, possibly. I mean, it was a very young convention, a lot of young attendees at this convention. I'm talking about many in teens, teenagers, and maybe some younger, but certainly a lot of 20-year-olds, a lot of millennials were there, and not as many of the gray-haired people like me who were around. So the point being is I think that everybody needs to be reminded to respect the rights of intellectual property, those who have gone on and have contributed and come up with these great ideas. And so he gave a short talk, and I say a short talk, about 20 or 30 minutes, kind of like what they do at Magic Live. If you had an opportunity to attend Magic Live, a similar kind of a TED Talk, if you will, type of a thing, but not a TED Talk because that's a copyrighted name, so it's a Magic Talk of some sort. But it was not a lecture of sorts where that's like, here's a trick, here's how it's done, here's another trick, here's how it's done, etc. So they were shorter talks about theory and philosophy and a lot of other things that are related to marketing, etc. But this first one was interesting, having to do with internet law. And I wanted to actually get this gentleman to talk with me about intellectual property, because we have had that as kind of a running theme here on the Magic Word Podcast for a long number of years, and it kind of comes and goes, and it just resurfaces from time to time where we talk about piracy or someone who has found out that their videos are now available streaming on some torrent site, or that ebooks have been stolen and they're available through some Chinese site or something, or books have been reprinted without the rights of the author being granted. And so how do we go about trying to avoid this problem? And after his speech was over, in fact, Max Maven was just sitting right behind me, and I turned around to talk with him about the very thing, because as I mentioned, I think over here on the podcast before, that Banachek and I have had our books and Psychological Subtleties have been ripped off and reprinted, as well as many of his other lecture notes and those kinds of things. And I was asking Mac, what do you do about this? And he said, there's really not too much you can do. It's kind of like whack-a-mole, that you knock one down here and it comes up someplace else. And that's unfortunately part of the problem. But some of it, I think, has to do with people who just don't understand that this is a living. This is how that magicians are making part of their living, not just from performing, but also by selling some of their ideas through videos and through books and ebooks, etc., and online lectures. And so by giving these away, that you are not only disrespecting them, but it is illegal as well. And so anyhow, we go into that in this discussion here this week with Doug Eisenberg, who is the creator of Giga.law, that's Giga.law, and he talks about protection of domains and also about how there are dozens and dozens of different domains. I mean, like .com, .gov, .org, and like in his case, .law, and you have .tv, et cetera, et cetera. So this is not a commercial about promoting his business necessarily, but he is someone who is a magician, understands magic, and also the problems that magicians have with trying to protect their intellectual property. And so that's why he was speaking at this convention, which, by the way, for those who are convention organizers, might like to consider having him as a speaker at your convention. He certainly opens up a conversation that I think that we should have, and this dialogue should be ongoing, and so that way that more people would have an understanding and appreciation and respect for the intellectual property that magicians produce. And so it's not just the product of their performance, but as I said, the physical things that they produce then as well that needs to be protected and respected. So that's a lot of what we're going to be talking about over here this week. Now, I'm not an attorney, but he is. So I, and I know that we're probably asking more questions than the answers that you're getting back for this. And there may be more questions that you have that were unasked. And so I would suggest that if you want to find out more information, that you would either contact Doug directly, and he talks about that at the end of this podcast, how to get in touch with him, or someone else, perhaps, if you feel that you have a case that you would like to have pursued, or if you want to see about how that you can go about copywriting your material, and he talks about that in this podcast as well. So I'm going to kind of back out of the way because there's a lot he has to say, and I think a lot we'll have to learn just from this podcast, and it's one that's very important in our industry. It's been a conversation a long time coming, and I'm glad we finally had a chance to sit down and talk with Doug Eisenberg here this week on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast.com, and today I have someone who was a speaker at the recent Magi Fest where we had attended, and he was actually the opening speaker in the opening session. Was the first speaker up in talking about internet law, and it's something that we've discussed a lot here on the Magic Word, and I thought it best actually we talk to someone who is an attorney and knows about it and can tell us something about it. Please welcome my guest today, Doug Eisenberg. Hi there, Doug.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thanks very much for having the time to chat with me about this and to let some of the listeners know about what some of their legal options are and kind of what this is about. Just by way of background, can you tell us a little bit about Giga Law, your company, and kind of what it is you do so that way that people kind of know more about you from your words?
Sure, sure. Well, it's funny because as the Magi Fest bio had said, I'm an attorney, not a magician, which thankfully did not scare everybody away from attending. there was still a nice room full of folks there. But no, I am an attorney. I've been practicing law since the mid-90s as an intellectual property attorney. Intellectual property law includes copyrights, trademarks, and patents, although I don't do any patent law. In recent years, almost for my whole career, really, I've been sort of focusing on internet law, mostly helping companies and individuals protect themselves and their legal rights online. But I used to be a magician, and I call myself a magic enthusiast. My son, Ari Eisenberg, who's 16 now, is the real magician. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we keep going back to Magi Fest. But I was a kid magician and unfortunately just did not stick with it. So my interest has kind of gotten renewed in recent years as a result of my son.
Well, there are a lot of attorneys, certainly a lot of professional people in other careers, obviously, that are magicians as well. The one thing that there are not many magicians are accountants for some reason. I don't know, accountants, typically and stereotypically, I should say, are rather more traditional and beige and maybe don't want to feel like that, that make their clients feel like that they are too creative. They want to make sure that the numbers are the numbers, but other professions, seem to embrace magic because of its creativity.
Well, I wish I could find more ways to work magic into what I do with my clients. And the only way that I've found so far, because I do a fair amount of speaking, is to work a torn and restored newspaper, for example, into a presentation. But I try to do something that is not performing, but actually, fits in with the topic of what I'm talking about. And probably if I had more talent as a magician. Maybe I would do that more frequently, but I really enjoy it. As Josh Jay once said, I'm probably, more like a director than a performer. So whatever, I like being around it. And I've sort of, found this area, the intersection of the law and magic, very interesting as well.
Well, you certainly found a unique niche and a good point in time also with Giga Law. And now Giga Law was, what's the, I guess, Giga, like for gigabytes type of thing?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. Back around the year 2000 or so, before the word blog, I think, existed, I started blogging about these issues, that is, technology and the law. And so I created a website that at the time was called gigalaw.com. It's a trademark that I created. You're exactly right, Scott. Giga, just to sort of denote technology like gigabytes or gigahertz.
Right.
So it was sort of an informational website where I and some other attorneys and law professors were writing about these developing issues in internet law. And anyway, I ended up writing a book a number of years ago that Random House published called The Giga Law Guide to Internet Law. And then when I began practicing law on my own, I think about 13 years or so ago, I decided to keep my own branding that I had created and associate it with my own legal practice. So now I have a website still at Giga Law, although interesting, within the past year or so, a large part of what I do is related to domain names and domain name disputes, which is a very important topic for anybody who does business online. And as you may know, there are now well over 1,000 new top-level domains. So this may be beyond the scope of what your audience is interested in, but I transitioned my website to the domain name giga.law, just because it's an interesting area. So that's where I am online, and I still do blog a lot about these issues and even post daily sort of curated news clips about technology law.
Well, now you're in a unique situation. Certainly this is something that's going to be on forever. I mean, we are of the internet age, and this is the beginning of the future, certainly, or it has been over the last decade or so, as it's just exploded. And as a result, it seems to be the wild, wild west, and everybody is thinking that this is free and open and there aren't any laws. And perhaps early on there weren't, but they're being added all the time as people are infringing on other people's rights, intellectual rights and property rights. And I'm sure that's obviously what you're involved with. And that's what I want to talk with you about here today.
Yeah. And interestingly, because you just made a reference to new laws, there are not that many new laws. A lot of the laws that we deal with, whether they're magic online or any other content online, are traditional copyright laws and other existing laws that have adapted to the new technology. There are some specific new laws, and I talked about a couple of them at the Magi Fest presentation. But for the most part, the law seems to adapt pretty well, not always perfectly, to the new technology that we see.
Well, right off the bat, first thing that comes to mind that we have talked about a lot here, and that is infringement of intellectual property. That is particularly, I guess, internationally, where we might see, let's say, the Chinese have been accused of stealing some intellectual property, that is, republishing something without having the rights to do so, or for copying videos and torrent sites and things like that. I mean, kind of opening a wide area here. But, is there anything at all that can be done right now with international law, or is that just something that we just have to write a petition and see what can happen?
Well, I included some examples in the Magi Fest presentation. For example, one I remember was a Chinese website, a torrent site that allowed anybody to download for free copies of one of Sean Farquhar's videos that he sells for one of his tricks. And, it's a problem, yes, in China, but it's a problem right here in the United States as well. And the issue really is it is so simple for, anybody to become a copyright infringer on the internet.
Sure.
And this is not new. It's, as old as probably as the World Wide Web itself. And it's not unique to the magic industry, certainly. We saw a lot of music copyright infringement litigation, even getting up to the, U.S. Supreme Court, starting back in the mid-90s. And so it is a real problem. And the laws are certainly very helpful. And we've got a great law. One of the new laws that we have in the United States, and I say new, it's actually, I guess, 20 years old now, but did not exist before the internet, is the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which basically makes it easier, not necessarily easy, but easier depending upon the circumstances and who's involved, to get some infringing content taken down from the internet. And it doesn't necessarily matter where the infringer is around the world. And so, you know, part of the problem is we do have this hodgepodge of laws around the world and a mixture of respect or disrespect for intellectual property online. And so the problem is never going to go away, just as, you know, speeding laws are never going to prevent everybody from speeding the streets.
Yeah.
Copyright laws, no matter how many laws we may have and how strong they may be and which countries may adopt them, they're never going to prevent the problem or you know, to totally solve it.
Right. You know, after your presentation, it just so happened that I have I'm business partners with Banachek, and I've published his book, Psychological Subtlety series, and all of that. And someone had sent me a copy from a Chinese site that was all in Chinese. I couldn't read it, but basically showed the picture where they had combined all three of the books into one hardback text and translated it from English to Chinese. And, you know, nothing I can do, I guess, really about that. And Max Maven was sitting behind me, and I turned around and asked him, and I said, you know, have you, I'm sure you've seen this too. And he said, it's like whack-a-mole. There's nothing you can do. He said, you know, we just, as soon as you try to shut down one, two more open up somewhere else.
That's exactly right. And I tell my clients that all the time, and they tell me that also. But what I say is that that doesn't mean that you should do nothing. Mm-hmm. So just because there is a problem, you may not be able to solve it, but you may be able to make a difference.
And well, no, that's a good point. Isn't that true that you have to, in order to try to protect your copyright, that you have to pursue it? You just can't, because if you just let it go, then before long, it's like then becomes public domain if no one has been trying to protect it actively.
Well, that's more true of trademarks,
okay.
which protect the names, for example. So there's, you know, a long history of names that once were trademarks. For example, escalator actually used to be the brand name for a moving staircase. Hmm. And, you know, there are all sorts of, you know, common examples of other trademarks that are
like
in
Kleenex.
Danger, for example, exactly, of becoming generic. Mm-hmm. Kleenex still is a trademark. So is Q-tip, so is Band-Aid, you know, but they're dangerously close to becoming the word that describes the product rather
yes.
than a brand of the product. So that's why you often hear trademark attorneys such as myself saying you need to enforce and police your rights, whether it's on the internet or in the physical world, or you risk actually losing those rights. As far as trademark rights are concerned, copyright is a bit different. It's still very important to enforce your copyright rights. And I've got clients who have done a very good job by enforcing their rights. They've made it well known that they are going to come after infringers. And as a result, some of the infringers simply decide to go pick on somebody else.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not, that's kind of shifting things around a bit. And again, it's not totally solving the larger issue, but it's, you know, helping to make it less of an issue for, you know, one of my clients, or, you know, and the same thing could be said for magicians as well.
Well, so like a car thief, I guess, who is going to be going through a parking lot, he's just going to be checking for a car that's unlocked. And if it's one's locked or a house, he'll just go to one that's easier to break into. And so, yeah, I mean, that theft is going to continue out there. Can you separate or define, I guess, the difference between copyright and trademark?
Sure. Well, copyright protects what are called original works of authorship. So, for example, books and songs and artwork and plays and movies, even computer software. Those are things that are original works of art. They have a creator. And they are protected by copyright law. Trademarks, on the other hand, typically protect words or logos or names and identify the source of a particular product. So something can be protected by both trademark and copyright law, But there are different laws that apply to each and how you obtain those protections and how long the protections last, for example. And what's interesting is with both, you can obtain legal rights to both trademarks and copyrights without applying for a registration. There are great advantages in actually getting a registration for a trademark or getting a registration for a copyright. And the process is different, and there are different fees that apply to both. You can obtain both trademark and copyright protection on your creations and your names, depending upon what you actually have created.
Is that something that you have to file for then, Doug? In other words, or can you just, for an example, when you publish your lecture notes or a booklet or whatever, that if you just say copyright at such and such a date, does that automatically say it's copyrighted, or does that need to be filed?
No, that's a great question. And under U.S. law, which is, just to be clear, all that I'm talking about so far with you and going to be talking about with you, because I'm a U.S. lawyer.
Yes.
Under U.S. copyright law, if what you created is copyrightable, then it is copyrighted from the moment of creation.
Okay.
So you write those lecture notes. Have the potential to be protected by copyright law immediately. You do not need to put that notice on there that you were referring to. You do not need to file an application with the U.S. Copyright Office. But you should do both of those things. And a proper copyright notice, you know, includes the word copyright or the circle C plus the year in which you created it, and your name or whoever the copyright owner's name is. And filing an application to the Copyright Office, which you can do for $35. And you can certainly do it yourself, although it's interesting because I've had somebody contact me just recently after the Magi Fest lecture that I gave on this topic, who's encountered some problems based on a copyright application that they had filed on their own without the assistance of a lawyer. So certainly there are some things that some advice that lawyers can provide that might make the process a little more efficient and work better for you. But once you register at the U.S. Copyright Office, then you have the right to enforce your copyright rights in a court of law. So if you ever do need to sue somebody else for copyright infringement, you will need a registration at the U.S. Copyright Office. And if you have obtained that registration promptly, and the law spells out in some detail what that actually means, from the time that you created or the time that you first published your lecture notes or other copyrightable work, then you are actually able to obtain what are called statutory damages, mm-hmm. which basically means that you can obtain money if you show infringement in a specified range without having to show how you were actually damaged and in what amount, because sometimes it's very difficult to say what your actual damages were. So there's some real advantages in filing that.
A couple of questions. One would be that can you still sue for damages if you have not filed for copyright? And number two, how long is that period of time that might lapse before that you can no longer file for that copyright? In other words, if you publish something, I don't know, 10, 15, whatever, X number of years ago, and you just put inside the lecture notes or the booklet or whatever, the copyright logo and certain date, and that was 10 years ago, but you actually didn't file for that, then and someone does infringe on your rights and copies that and tries to sell it as their own, do you have legal right to recourse to go back and sue them at that point?
You can apply for a copyright registration at any time.
Okay.
Even if it was something that you created 10 or 15 years ago, you can file for the copyright registration, and you will need to do so before you actually go to file a copyright infringement complaint in court. Mm-hmm. What you might not be able to obtain, though, as a result, are these so-called statutory damages. So if too much time has passed between the time that you actually created or published the work and the time that you file the copyright application, you will the only remedy that you will be able to obtain in court is an injunction, that is a court order stopping the defendant from continuing to infringe, right, such as by publishing the content on a website, or actual damages. So you will have to prove to a court, what your actual damages were. In other words, just as one argument, I lost X number of sales as a result of this infringement,
right,
or X number of copies of the infringing work were sold at this dollar amount. And that, frankly, might not add up to very much. And sometimes is a much, much lower amount than you'll end up spending on legal fees, unfortunately, to pursue the damages. And I focused on that as well in the Magi Fest lecture, the very fascinating case that Teller brought against a YouTube user. And yes, he won a very substantial damages award. But as the court pointed out, he was seeking a much higher dollar figure as far as reimbursement of his legal fees and expenses in the case.
Yeah, I understand that. And it would seem that, I used to belong to the World Alliance of Magicians, and Walter Blaney was the president, and I was a vice president. At that time, the reason we had gotten that started was because when the Masked Magician had come out and was starting to expose some things on television, in particular, that Walter had his ladder levitation that had been ripped off in a few countries. And like in Africa, some people were saying, well, we can't afford to buy your prop because the cost for that is our annual wages, just to buy the prop. Well, okay, they're... I understand, but you still shouldn't be ripping off something that is my intellectual property. But the problem is, I guess, going to that kind of a thing. A lot of times, magic props are not patented, because if they do, then it becomes open to the public domain, and anybody can look it up, I guess, and see how this thing works. And if they want to, they can build one in their garage, I guess, as long as they're not, at least they think they can, I guess, illegally, as long as they're not using it in a public area that. Would get back. I don't know why they would necessarily do it, rather than paying for the rights legally to do that. But the point is that it would seem just exactly what you're saying there, Doug, where that it would be more expensive for a magician to try to patent his illusions or something that he wants to try to keep secret. Number one, it costs a lot. Number two, then it becomes public domain. Are both those things correct?
Sort of. There are a few different concepts there. And again, I'm not a patent lawyer, so I've sort of been focusing on the copyright and trademark pieces, which are different areas of the law. But you're certainly right when you say that obtaining patent protection is expensive, and obtaining patent protection does require disclosure of what you have created. So that's why I actually think copyright law is a much more effective tool for magicians to use. But ultimately I think too, there are some significant ethical and respect issues that are really above and beyond the law, so that I think it's certainly tempting to download something just because it's easily available.
Sure.
Or recreate something yourself.
Well, you talk about the respect for our art, and people shouldn't be doing it. It is easy, certainly, to download anything because, hey, it's there, it's free, and it's like, I was going to buy that anyhow, and what's it hurting? Well, you're taking money out of people's mouths, I don't think that I mentioned earlier on about this kind of being the Wild West from the standpoint that people think it's open, free, and easy, and as long as you've got a gun, that you can shoot them up, I guess. And so, and their gun is their mouse that they can click on something and hurt someone. They can download it, and so you're hurting somebody with that click of the mouse or that click of the gun, because you're stealing from someone, basically. And I think that there seems to be a feeling today that since the internet's free, everything on there should be free. And let me just go one step further, and then we'll come back to that in just a second. But I was talking about internationally and with Chinese and others. I had an interesting comment that someone had said to me that it could be having to do with a communist country, from the standpoint that communists were thinking that this is communal property and something that belongs to the state, and so therefore it doesn't belong to me, and so therefore it should be free and open. Everything else is free to the people, so this should be also. So we should be able to make this, because it's just a communist ideology.
Well, I don't know much about communism and intellectual property law, but I will say this: under U.S. law, The origins of copyright and patent protection, for that matter, are in the U.S. Constitution, which actually has a clause in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of the Constitution. You can go look it up, which basically gives power, gives Congress the power to create laws to promote the progress of science and the useful arts, is what it says. And so what that really means is we have these laws in the United States to give an incentive to create, so that, if you could not protect what you create, then you might not create it in the first place. And if there is enough infringement going on, out there, then the incentive for magicians and others to continue to create might diminish. And I certainly think that's not something that we want to see. So if you want to see great music and great movies and great books and great magic, then do not infringe.
I think that part of that is that there are not a lot of creators. There are a lot of consumers. And I have spoken with people who have been discouraged, who have been creative people in magic and who have contributed a lot, and have little at a time pulled back saying, this is crazy, you know, because I spent so much time in research and development and all this, and then someone else rips me off, and even though, and they're selling it in the United States, but having it made over in China, so they can have it made, you know, someplace over there and bring it back, and you know, then this person will contact the person since it's being sold in the U.S. And try to get them to stop, and having really no luck because they don't have the funds necessarily, because just as you'd said earlier, it costs more to litigate than it does for the damages that you receive.
Right. And it's awfully discouraging, you know, as I hear you describe the situation and I hear it from my clients too, and other magicians as well. You know, it's easy to sort of just, you know, throw up your arms and, you know, kind of give up with the situation. Gosh, don't.
okay.
Please. You know, I think there was a time, you know, in the, mid to late 90s when Napster was new.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it just seemed like everybody, was downloading music illegally,
Correct.
Know, for free on the internet, that, you know, we sort of thought, okay, this is going to be the end of the music industry. And, you know, what happened is we saw the music industry, change its business models in some ways. And, you know, music is about a lot more than just buying songs. So I think we've seen, you know, a bit of a resurgence, in, concerts and merchandising and other sort of revenue streams that musicians have. And perhaps, you know, magicians could, you know, learn something from that as well. So it's not just about, can I protect this trick? Because more often than not, the answer is going to be no. That's what the court told us in the Teller case, actually, which is magic tricks are not copyrightable, although the case was much more complicated than that. But ultimately, your success as a magician, whether you're, you know, a full-time professional or an enthusiast like myself or somewhere in between, which is where most people are, I suppose, who are at these conventions and probably listening to your podcast. Ultimately, the success of magic is not going to depend on how strongly the laws protect magic.
Well, certainly the music industry is tremendously larger than the magic industry, and so there's a lot more money, and so there's money behind it, I guess, to try to enforce that. And you're right, they did embrace that, such that it's okay, well, we're going to sell digital downloads rather than giving them away. We'll kind of put a stop, and if that's what, you know, the market has proven, that's what we want. We just want this song. We don't want the whole album, you know, or the whole disc or whatever. Similarly, I think that we're seeing individual downloads of videos, I should say, individual tricks on downloads, as opposed to a full lecture or DVD that would have 10, 12, a dozen tricks or three or four set. Although those are selling well also, the ones that seem to be the most popular are the cheaper ones that are just a one trick download, similar to the, you know, one song download that iTunes sells. So little at a time, I think we're kind of seeing that and evolving to that because it's just a reaction to, consumer needs.
Right. Well, and interestingly, somebody made a comment, I think, at, Magi Fest, you know, sort of about how books are, you know, the least popular sellers of, you know, on from the Magic websites and the Magic dealers.
Yeah, hard copy books, but, yeah, are going down. Right. It's true. Just like magazines and newspapers, right.
It's true, but you know, and I'm a huge reader of all
times.
Me too. I do a lot of reading on my iPad, and certainly as I sit at my desk all day long. But when it comes to magazines, for example, I still prefer a hard copy. And when it comes to some of these Magic books, I mean, I've seen, you know, having attended conventions now for the last 6 or 8 years, and following the Magic community, you know, a lot more closely than certainly I ever did. There are some beautiful books, by the way, out there, and there's some great books coming out. And so there's something to be had, I think, from having that hard copy product that is different than having just a digital version of it. And so, you know, I think there are at least some people who still want that physical product. And, you know, just because you can scan it and upload it and share it for free illegally, it doesn't mean that that's what everybody's going to want anyway.
That's true. No, I agree. I like to hold that as well. But there was a proliferation of desktop publishing when there was just a boom and everyone was publishing everything, but then it kind of scaled back as digital kind of took over. But you're right. You know, I'd rather, you know, be able to hold the thing, you know, than myself.
Right. Exactly. Put your fingers in the page, open it up, and so forth. I mean, I've got still, and I'm very, you know, proud of it. I've got, I think, a 1977, autographed copy of Mark Wilson's Course in Magic, you know, that I obtained when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, that to me is very special. And obviously I've saved it. It's in pretty good condition after all these years.
Yeah.
I gave it to my son,
when
he started to get interesting in Magic. Right. Exactly. And, you know, that can't be replaced by a digital copy.
Right. Right. I hate to go back for just a moment, but there was something that you'd said, and I don't want to overlook this. And you said you cannot copyright a trick. And I'm assuming, like, if you have a card trick or a gimmick pack of cards or something, that means that you can't copyright that. However, that I believe what Teller was suing for was the performance, intellectual rights of the performance that he was doing. So in other words, that the trick itself and the process, I guess, the gimmick that was used is not something that is copyrightable, but the presentation is. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what you're talking about is the Shadows case, Teller's Shadows illusion, with cutting the petals off of a rose first, you know, on a shadow, and then the actual physical petals fall. Mm-hmm. And so he had sued a YouTube user who had posted a couple of videos that were, as the court later found, substantially similar, which is the test for copyright infringement. And the courts told us in that case that magic tricks are not copyrightable. But what the court did say is Teller did have a valid copyright registration for the pantomime, actually, of what he had performed. And so it was not the magic trick that was copyrightable, but it was his performance of it. And somebody can infringe somebody else's performance rights. And that's actually what happened in the Shadows case.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's very important to keep in mind. And what that really means is I also said at the Magi Fest lecture, you know, a specific, effect, you know, making a woman levitate or tearing up and restoring a newspaper. Those cannot be protected under copyright law, but specific performances of them can be, or books written about them can be, or videos teaching how to perform those tricks. You know, those types of things certainly can be protected under copyright law.
Yeah, a few years ago, Bruce Servon had written a book, and it was interesting because I think this was the first time that someone had written on the inside there saying that these effects are all protected, and, you know, I will hold the rights to perform these myself. So basically what he was saying after people were buying the book, said, well, why am I buying the book if I can't perform them? I believe what he was trying to say was that if I'm working in a trade show or a similar environment, we were both in the same show, that I have the priority to perform this. If I'm not there, then you can do that. Is that something that is enforceable? If somebody else was performing that same trick, let's say at a trade show or something, because he had said that, would that be something that would be enforceable?
Well, I mean, once you own a copyright, you then have the right to prevent others from reproducing your copyright or preparing derivative works of your copyright. And so, you know, ultimately the question is, do you have something that's copyrightable in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
If so, then you can decide what, if anything, and maybe the answer is nothing, you want somebody else to do with it. So, you know, I think certainly as far as magic product sales are concerned, we see this a lot, you know, performance rights, you know, reserved, or, you know, some other rights. And I think they have different meanings to different people. And simply because you assert, you know, and say that you have a certain right, or you won't allow somebody else to do something, does not necessarily mean that the law actually gives you that right. You have to have something that's legally protectable in the first place. Hmm. But I think what we see when we see those types of notices are they're really more in the form of requests sometimes than they are an assertion of
request
legal rights.
Request for respect.
I mean, they could be both, certainly. But yes, you're exactly right, Scott. They're requests for respect. And, you know, there is this, you know, magic community. Obviously, not everybody feels the same way and plays by the same rules.
Right.
But a lot of people do have that respect and should have that respect for their fellow magicians.
In that regard, that was something that you had concluded your presentation with the four or five R's.
I was just trying to give a little bit of practical advice, because as I went through the presentation, I think I talked a lot about the law and sort of theory. But the three R's that I was talking about were, register, report, and respect. That is, you know, register your rights. We talked about that earlier on in this podcast, you know, with the trademark office, with the copyright office, because it's important to do so and relatively easy to do so. The second was to report. That is actually, if you are a copyright owner and you find infringing content online, yes, like you said, it may be akin to the whack-a-mole game. But through the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, process, you can report that infringing content and may be able to get it taken down. And then the third was, yes, to respect your fellow magicians, because it's incredibly important, as I said before, if we want the magic community to thrive and if we want to see more magic books being created and even conventions taking place, and if we really want to see magic thrive, then I think we all need to respect each other.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. And I believe that was, again, your talk was perfectly positioned there at the beginning. So this way, because we have a lot of young people who are there as well, who don't know the law, who perhaps are just getting involved in magic and will eventually will be the creators of tomorrow. And they need to understand kind of what's going on. So I thought that was great, too. Again, that you had said that you work with domains, and there are a lot out there, like you say, you know, .law, .tv, .com, .net, .org, whatever, et cetera, a lot of these. And are there issues that you see, or would you recommend, I guess, if somebody has a domain that you want with your name, how would you go about trying to see if you can get that person? I mean, do you camp out and kind of watch and see when that's going to be expiring, or what do you do?
You mean if somebody else has a domain name
that you want,
that you would like to have for yourself?
Yes.
There are two issues there, or really two different approaches. One is, do you have any legal rights that you can assert to the domain name? And that's what I just about every day in my legal practice am helping my clients with, because there's a large amount of what's called cyber squatting out there. That a cyber squatter is somebody who goes and registers a domain name that contains my client's trademark or a variation of my client's trademark. Mm-hmm. And usually they're doing so for some bad purpose, such as to put up a website where they sell counterfeit products, or for, you know, phishing purposes, phishing with a PH, that is, you know, to collect personally identifiable information from somebody who thinks they're providing it to the real trademark owner, such as to make a hotel reservation, and instead they're disclosing it to somebody else, or even pornography, or all sorts of bad things.
Sure.
So in those cases, you know, my clients are trademark owners, and we're talking about a domain name that is identical or confusingly similar to their trademark, and there's there are great ways,
like misspelling Disney or Coca-Cola or something. Yeah.
Yes. Or adding another word, to the trademark. And, you know, even the, you know, the word online or the name of a city, or easy, you know, something else, because there are an infinite number of domain names to be had.
And so,
fortunately the laws are pretty clear. And again, this is what I do every day in my practice is I get those, I'm filing complaints on behalf of my clients to get those domain names transferred to my clients, because they have a legal right to the domain name.
Or anything that sounds like it or could look like it.
Or yeah, it was something that is what the law calls confusingly similar. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be spelled the same way. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes they're what are called typo squats.
Sure.
typographical variations of a trademark, something that you might make if you were typing it too quickly, which is exactly what the bad guys want you to do.
Of course.
That's a different situation than you've identified simply a domain name that you would like to have. Maybe because it's your name or maybe because it's just a name that you like. But you don't have any trademark rights. That is, you don't have any legal right to assert. You cannot file a legal complaint against somebody simply because you want something.
Right. Okay.
And in that situation, and I help my clients with that as well, you can either simply say, well, this is, not something I'm going to pursue. And there are, as I said, and as you were mentioning just a minute ago, lots of new top level domains that most people don't really even realize exist, but that have come online in the last couple of years, from .law like I used to .guru and .london and dozens and dozens of others. But they're just not that popular. So
right.
Most people still want a .com. So if somebody else has a .com domain name that you're interested in and you do not have the legal right to assert against it, then the only thing you can really do is try to purchase it from somebody. And, just about everything is for sale. It's just a matter of price.
Yeah, I guess so.
And I've, helped clients buy domain names from three figures to seven figures. Obviously the situation is very different when you're talking about $1 million+ domain name, but those
sure.
transactions do happen. They're not that common. And unfortunately, what has happened is some people who have registered domain names, hear about these multi-million-dollar sales and immediately they think every domain name in their portfolio is equally as valuable.
Right.
Ultimately domain names are not like real estate. Because the comparables are really not the same. And certainly the cost of holding a domain name is not the same as the cost of holding real estate.
But it is legal to hold that. In other words, if you were to hold before Coca-Cola had theirs, or let's say Disney.com had theirs, that if you would have had Disney.com and then just kind of camped on it, waiting for them to come to you to buy that, that's a legal thing for you to purchase a domain?
Well, the rules today are a little bit different than they were 20, 25 years ago.
That makes sense, of course.
But when you register a domain name today, especially a .com, you have to agree to a registration agreement. And one of the terms in that agreement, and I understand most people don't read these agreements, even though we lawyers write them.
Just click agree.
Exactly. One of those terms says that you, agree that the domain name you are registering, does not infringe on anybody else's rights. And by the way, if a trademark owner wants to file a complaint against you for registering the domain name, then they can do so. So domain names, most of them, again, at least .coms and most others, are available on a first-come, first-served basis. But that does not mean that somebody who registers a domain name first has the legal right to it. It just means they were able to get it first.
Doing business as XYZ company and someone else is holding xyzcompany.com, but just holding it, but they're not doing business as that, you can legally come in and say, look, I'm actually the business owner of xyz.com business.
You may be able to do so depending upon the other facts of that situation.
Okay,
that
well, sure, of course.
That is when did your trademark rights arise versus when was the domain name registered,
mm-hmm.
And all sorts of other factors. So there were some very early cases when I first started doing this work in the mid-90s, and nobody knew what a domain name was. There were some very well-known cases. Two of them that come to mind were McDonald's.com and MTV.com.
Hmm.
The McDonald's case was actually a reporter for one of the technology magazines at the time went and registered McDonald's.com. He had no relationship to the fast food company, which is probably what most people think of when they hear McDonald's.
Right.
He was able to register McDonald's.com because, it's amazing, maybe people listening to your podcast were born after 1995. And so they don't have the appreciation that, you know, the internet, was not something that people knew about, at the time. And not something that every business wanted to be a part of. And so he wrote an article about his experience in registering McDonald's.com. He ultimately, you know, approached the fast food company, and make a long story short, he ended up transferring the domain name. The general point is just because a domain name is available, and even if you can get to it first, does not mean that you have the legal right to it.
Ah, that's interesting. You know, first time I ever heard about .com, it must have been about 1994, and I saw a billboard that said Star Wars. It had a big Star Wars billboard about one of the movies coming up. And on the bottom it said StarWars.com, and I thought, what the heck is .com? I think it said www, you know.
Right. And that, well, because in those days everybody was using AOL keywords.
Sure.
And again, that probably just went over the head of some of your listeners. That's what online was before the web.
Right.
And now, you know, there's a dot movie. And a dot film. So, you know, the new top level domains exist in part because of some of the saturation of .com.
Right.
And so there are other alternatives out there.
Right. Listen, I've taken up a lot of your very important time, and I really appreciate that. I know our listeners probably have a lot of questions, and they'll chase you, direct them to you, certainly not to me. So if they want to get hold of you then, Doug, how can they reach you?
Sure. The easiest way is through my website, which is GigaLaw. Just feel free to Google or use your favorite search engine. For those who might use something other than Google, I understand there are some people who do that. Just Google GigaLaw, and that's GigaLaw, or go to my website at giga.law, search for me online, Doug Eisenberg, Eisenberg. And I've got all my contact information and social media channels and so forth on my website.
And for those who might want to copyright something of their own, you're saying it's about $35 just to do a copyright filing. Is there a link on your website where people can click to download and complete the form, or do they need to go through you, or what do you recommend there?
They can certainly contact me, or you can learn a lot more from the website of the U.S. Copyright Office, which is at copyright.gov, G-O-V. All the forms are there, some great materials that explain more about copyright law. And as I said before, filing a copyright application is certainly something you can do on your own, although there are some advantages that lawyers can bring to the table.
Right, right. And one last thing, I guess, where do you think this is going? What is the direction? I mean, you've seen just some radical changes, and you said there were very little laws and there are more being written. Where do you see this 5, 10, 15 years down the road?
Well, you know, I have been doing this work for well over 20 years, and probably about 15 years ago, somebody said to me, well, talking about online infringement and domain name disputes and so forth. So we were about, you know, maybe 5 years into seeing these issues. And somebody said to me, well, haven't really all these issues been resolved by now? You know, this was before, you know, around the year 2000 or so.
Sure.
And obviously here we are 18 years after that. And the answer is certainly not. So unfortunately, you know, the cynic in me says, you know, 15 or 20 years from now, we're still going to be dealing with these same issues. Mm-hmm. There are still going to be infringers. The laws that we have now probably are still going to be around, with maybe a few new laws to address some new issues, maybe not. But I think, you know, what will change more probably is the technology rather than the law. At least that's what's happened in the last 20 years. And unfortunately, on that count, my crystal ball just isn't working too well, because who could have predicted where we are now 20 years ago?
What should we do as a magician then? I mean, is there anything that we could do right now? If you see something, report something, kind of a thing?
Yeah, I think simply doing what you're doing right now, what you and I are doing right now, which is talking about these issues, is probably the first and most important thing. Because as you said, there are probably a lot of young magicians who are really unaware of what the laws are. As an intellectual property attorney, you know, this is something I have emphasized to my magician son and my other children as well, even outside of magic, you know, what infringement is mm-hmm. and what is legal and right to do and what is illegal and wrong to do. And so the more of these types of conversations that we can have on a podcast, at a convention, at a Magic Club meeting, individually, in magazines and online, I think can go a very long way to simply educating people about what the law is, why we have the laws, and what the impact is of disregarding the laws, and what the importance is of enforcing your rights under the law.
Right. And, you know, I think what Josh and Andy had done was really starting something that the other should take notice. In other words, I think they should have you as a speaker, they being other conventions, the IBM, SAM, you name it, even the local or regional conventions should bring you or someone like you to come and talk about internet law, because it is something that's with us now and it's going to be here for a long time, and everyone really needs to know those three things again. You said what? Register, report, and respect?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Yep. Good way of finishing there. Hey, one last thing then, and this, and I'll let you go. And the course name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So my question then to you, Doug, is, what is your magic word, or what is your phrase? What is it that you live by? It doesn't have to be a word. It could be a sentence, a phrase, just a philosophy of life.
I have a lot of trite phrases, I think that I live with. You know, one of them, I remember a fraternity brother in college, once said to me, you know, work hard and play hard and know when to do each. And you know, that was a very different thing, mm-hmm. when I was, 20 years old than, it is today. But I think that, you know, has a lot of meaning, you know, wherever you are in life. You know, we all wear a lot of different hats, maybe magicians literally, but, which is not what I meant.
Touché.
You know, whether you are, you know, a spouse or a child or a parent, or a friend or a coworker or a business partner or an employee, you know, there are lots of roles that we all play in life, and it's a real challenge to do them all well.
Sure.
But, you know, focusing on one at a time and doing the best at it, but then remembering that, oftentimes we need to, you know, take off one hat and put on another, and then do that job as well as possible is an important thing to do.
Right. And know when to do each. That's great.
Exactly.
Thank you, Doug, very much again for your time and for all of your advice and everything. And I'm going to, put some of these links up also on the blog so that way people can know where to go, when they want to contact you, if they want some more advice or something. And again, they should get hold of you through the website and, leave a message, and you're going to be quick to get back to them, I'm sure.
Great. Thanks a lot, Scott. Thanks for
all
having
right.
me.
And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Doug Eisenberg with Giga Law. This is Scotty out. Well, I again want to really give a big thank you to Mr. Doug Eisenberg for being my guest this week on The Magic Word. I appreciate the time that he had taken away from his busy schedule in order to give us a little bit of time to talk about some important things that, again, we've discussed occasionally here on The Magic Word Podcast, and I know that this is something that is of interest to magicians. And as he had suggested, that if there is some specific advice that you would like to have, some legal advice, you can contact him at giga.law. And if you go to that website, there's a place that'll you can contact him and put in some information, whatever you want to know. But again, I tried to kind of cover some broad bases here without getting into too much specifics. We're not asking for free advice, but if you're wanting to get some advice and some good legal advice, sounds like that he's the guy that would be able to help you if you're looking to get something, make sure that you have it branded, copyrighted, registered, everything that you need to know properly, and what recourse you might have if someone tries to infringe upon your intellectual property. And now for something a little bit different. This is going to be a product review of something that actually had appealed to me, and I thought I would share it with you guys. It is not something that is available from your favorite magic dealer, nor comes from Murphy's Magic Supplies, but it actually comes from the Ace Magic Studio, which is over in the UK. And this is something that's been developed by Gary Sumpter, and it's a book test. Now, before you kind of switch off or fast forward, let me explain. This is not your usual book test. And again, I'm excited about this, and I think it's just tremendous on many accounts. First of all, typical book tests, of course, are just that you will have somebody open a book, let's say, ideally, they look at a word and they think of the word, you tell them the word they're thinking of, any word in the book. There are many ways of doing that, and I have most of them. I think I purchased a number over the years and spent thousands of dollars over the years in quite literally in the many book tests that I have purchased and used and like. But again, all of them really are just that. They are book tests and they look like a book test in which you're handing them out, giving them a free choice, et cetera, et cetera. This is different from the standpoint that it's not just a book. This is a recipe book. Very interesting. And not just a recipe book with real recipes that make good food, but also it's a very colorful recipe book and would go wonderful on your kitchen recipe shelf or in the home for someone that you can slip that in there, and that way that you could come back at some later time and do kind of a quote impromptu miracle with this recipe book. But it is very, very colorful. As I said, it's a high gloss kind of a thing. As I said, this was something that is made from over in the UK, and as a result, it is has different sizes. It comes like in an A4 size as well as a smaller pocket size as well for walk around, but the A4 size is something that is large enough that you can use it for a parlor or stage. Another cool thing about this is not only is it colorful and different because it's not just that you're thinking of a word, but there are three different ways of doing this. As they suggest, there's like an appetizer, main course, and a dessert. You can do one or all, kind of use a plug-and-play modular kind of a thing. Let me tell you, I guess, first of all, I forgot to say, this is called What's Cooking? The Book Test, and again by Gary Sumpter. And from the standpoint, let's say, for an example, on the cover, that you would just have somebody to think of a vegetable. And then also there's a breakfast item that's on there as well. And there are ways of forcing things, I mean, like, let's say, a shape that's going to be a simple geometric shape, and also a flower and a color. And when they then look at the book, which they've already looked at, they've thumbed through the book and it has about 200 plus pages, then on the cover are several vegetables, so you pretty much have a pretty good wide range of choices, but most of all, of course, carrot is the one that's most obvious. And then also there's some coffee, there is a red rose, red wine. There's a pizza, so you got a triangle sitting on a plate. And if somebody says, well, I was thinking of a circle inside of a triangle rather than a triangle inside of a circle, so if you'll notice, then of course, the piece of pizza actually has pepperoni, so there are some round pieces inside the piece of pizza. So that would be kind of just a beginning part of the book test from the standpoint that'd be like a little appetizer. So then you would just have them, again, they flip through the book and they just name any page number. It doesn't make really any difference at all. And by doing that, you would say, okay, I want you to focus then on the pictures that are on there. There are a lot of colorful, large photos. And as you would do that, then they were holding the book up and you were standing across the stage, you know, several feet away from them or whatever. And in this case, that you are going to then be able to tell them what color they are looking at. What is the color of the item? Not necessarily what it is, but let's say it's going to be red or orange or green or purple or yellow or something like that. Also, then concentrate on what the first word is on the top of the page. That would have to do with this. I don't know the whole recipe that you may be looking at, but I believe that the first word is, and then you kind of do a little thought reading. It could be homemade or fresh or delicious, tempting, different words like that. And then also there is another little piece in there in which there'd be a number like a clock, and you could tell them what time that is or what number is in that little dial. And then finally, for the dessert, you can do a drawing duplication. So they just, again, select a page, they open up the book, and then you have a drawing tablet or a dry erase board, and that you can draw the item that they're looking at and thinking of, and then, of course, show the audience. And it is also kind of a fun little thing you can kind of play with, it such that you might actually miss it, and then you say, wait a minute, I've got the pieces right, but I've got them in the wrong order. Then you redraw the pieces, and it fits exactly what it is that they had said. There are some other ideas. The instruction booklet that you get with this is the same. I have the A4 size, but you know, the instruction booklet's the same size, high gloss, high quality. This is, I can't express how how great a quality this product really is. And there are some great tips at the end by different people like Peter Turner and Michael Murray. And one of the things that Michael Murray had pointed out then also is that if you know and you can remember some of the page numbers, when people say, okay, I want to select page number, whatever it is, that's like, let's say between page 10 and 28 are all breads, between 32 and 50 are all meats. 54 to 72 is healthy eating. And then later they got soups and then desserts and baking, seafood and pizzas. And so they're divided that way. So if you have something, you could actually go into it a little bit more. And there are even more kinds of little tips and presentations that you could make this into. Not a full, well, yes, a full-blown routine, but not into a full-blown act. But it is something that is, I think, really good. It's beautiful, again, because not only is it well-produced, well-published, I mean, it's beautiful to look at, but it is so much different from just opening up and then you telling them what the word is that you're thinking of, or perhaps reading the first phrase, and you tell them the first phrase that's on the top of the page or whatever, of some novel or fiction or whatever. This takes it out of the realm of something that is typically seen. Now, what I am familiar with is Larry Becker and Lee Earle's idea that has to do with, and also John Archer had an idea with this as well, with the travel guide. So it'd be like a pocket travel guide, and there are pictures in the travel guide, there are maps, and you know exactly where they're going to be going when they open the page. Some of the street signs and the names of the streets and some other things that are on the pages, and there are several pictures. And so that I have always liked also, because, again, it takes it out of the realm of just a book test. But this is something that I think that people can relate to. Everybody likes to travel. Everybody maybe who hasn't traveled to certain places likes the destination. And so that little travel guide, I think, is just a map guide, again, that those guys had made, is just a wonderful idea. Well, this just kind of takes that to a different degree, because everybody likes to eat. And not everybody may like to cook, but you certainly know what a recipe book is. And this is something that... without being sexist, I think that, you know, men and women both who are chefs or who like to cook in the kitchen, as opposed to cooking elsewhere. Yeah, you always cook in the kitchen. This is something I think that they would could relate to. And as I said, it's actually a real recipe book. Anyhow, I think it's incredible. It's something new and revolutionary. And then finally, I guess that makes this even more over the top, in my opinion, is it's how inexpensive that it is. It's about $100 for the large size in U.S. Money. So, you know, I was talking with Greg Wilson about this just recently, and Gregory was kind of blinking his eyes. He said, it's a bargain at twice the price. You know, it's just a heck of a deal. Now, of course, over here, we would have to pay for the foreign shipping coming from the UK over here. So that'll add quite a bit more onto it. But still, at the low price of only $100, ish, depending upon what the exchange rate's going to be, that it still comes in at a good bargain. So this is something that not only will you like, you will use, and you will begin showing this to people then right away. Again, the instructions are quite clear, and the code for knowing what's on the page is a very nice and subtle thing too. The way that it is. You don't have to memorize it. I'm not going to go into the details as to how this is done, but there is something that is very clever. You don't have anything in your hand whatsoever. You can. It does come with a little index card that you can palm and you can look at. However, that you really don't even need that because of the method that Gary has put together. Anyhow, I think this is a very good deal to not only financially to purchase, but also because it's something I think that you'll use and put into your act. Again, it's called the What's Cooking Book Test, and it's by Gary Sumpter. And if you just do a little Google search for the Ace Magic Studios, you can find it. And highly recommended by the Magic Word Podcast. Well, again, I hope that you enjoyed this episode of the Magic Word Podcast, and also a little extended version of what was kind of like a TED Talk, if you will, from Doug Eisenberg there at Magi Fest. So he expanded a lot more here this week, and I got a lot out of this, and certainly some food for thought. And I hope that you enjoyed that little tasty tidbit then as well. See how I did that? Going back to the book test? Anyway. Well, that's a wrap for this week. So until next week,
Stay well, get booked, and work hard, play hard, and know when to do each. This is Scotty out.